This podcast is brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those that love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew. For this episode of the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast, I am in Vermont and we are sitting here in the quality lab for Von Trapp Brewing. Welcome to the podcast, Tom Everett, Director of Brewing Ops, and Jack Von Papegem, Quality Manager for Von Trapp. Welcome, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jamie.
Von Trapp, over the years, has made a wave with craft beer and brewing. Of course, 2018, Oktoberfest was one of our best 18 beers of 2018. You all have won a couple of medals at World Beer Cup and
GABF.
Yeah, 2015.
Yeah, yeah. So Bohemian Pils, I believe, is you've got medals at both World Beer Cup and GABF for Bohemian Pils. And have built quite a lager brewing operation up here on the mountainside outside of Stowe. It is an incredible production facility for the narrowness and tightness and hairpin bends of the roads that get up here. And I have no idea how these trucks navigate.
Winter can be interesting for sure.
Absolutely. But over that, you also, have done lots of partnerships with other brewers and have built a reputation for fantastic lager brewing up here. And we're going to talk about the Von Trapp approach to lager brewing. Of course, it's a beautiful complex, not just with the brewery, but also with the lodge. And of course, there's a long family story. We're not going to focus on the family story on this episode. There's plenty of folks that have covered it. And of course, it is connected to the Sound of Music and that whole past. Plenty of other folks that have told that story. We're going to leave it there. We're going to talk about brewing on this episode. Before we do, at G&D Chillers, they always strive to build great chillers. Partner with them as you build great beer. Kevin Toger from Bearded Iris Brewing says, G&D Chillers have been a valuable partner throughout our growth. They build high-quality equipment and know their machines extremely well. Most importantly, their customer service is best in class, which is a huge value add to our internal teams that manage these critical support systems, end quote. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring on your new G&D chiller. And ProBrew is the industry partner that brewers trust to take their operations to the next level, especially when it comes to canning their product for distribution. By partnering with ProBrew, brewers can fill and seam their canned product. It ranges from 100 to 600 cans per minute. Their unique filling process also ensures low dissolved oxygen pickup and focuses on product quality during the entire process. For more information, visit probrew.com or email them at contactus@probrew.com. ProBrew, brew your beer. Also, Old Orchard has supplied flavored craft juice concentrate blends to over 46 states for the production of fruit-forward beer, cider, seltzer, wine, spirits, and more. By partnering with some of the biggest names in the craft brewing landscape, Old Orchard has become a go-to source of fruit-forward ingredients. To learn more and request your free samples, head on over to oldorchard.com/brewer. Funny circumstance happened as I was planning this trip earlier this week and got a text from Austin Grippen, one of our original interns who he got into digital marketing with us like back in 2014, 2015, way back in the day. And now he's working here at Von Trapp and just started working here.
Yeah, we're super fortunate to have him. He just started, so we'll see how it goes for sure.
You'd be tough on him, right?
Oh, you better believe it. Yeah.
Funny to watch how all these worlds collide, recombined, and come back together there. So excited about that, but so cool. Anyway, Tom, why don't you give me a little bit on your background and tell me a little bit about the Von Trapp story here.
So my personal experience with Von Trapp Brewing has been pretty awesome. I'm very fortunate to work here. I've been here 11 years now. We started at the Deli Bakery up on the hill, running a 15-barrel brew house, putting out 1,900 barrels, I think was our max 1 year. It was two of us. I was trained under JP Williams, who worked at Magic Hat for many years, and he allowed me or accepted me to come up to Von Trapp Brewing and very fortunate to be here. And then
Magic Hat is kind of a brewing school for a lot of
100%. A lot of great talented brewers came out of there, and it's great to see them all successful and grow, and fortunate to be a part of it a little bit, but not that I worked at Magic Hat, but
sure.
Know the people. Yeah,
there are those breweries all over the country, you know, like Goose Island and Chicago, where you just see the network of brewers that came in and moved out from there. And now we're seeing it like with Firestone Walker in California, the number of really talented brewers that have like cut their teeth and learned in these, you know, larger brewing environments, the high quality brewing environments that have gone out and done cool things. It's interesting to watch those kind of hubs and spokes.
Yeah. It's nice to see, you know, the development, and, you know, hopefully we can be like a lager school here and like apprentice, and maybe Austin Griffin can, you know, spread his wings and start his own lager brewery one day. But no. And then we expanded 2015. We expanded and built this 35,000 square foot, 50 barrel Rolec brew house. And it's been a monster achievement. And
with dedicated decoction vessel.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty rad to see. And then
I was talking to Chris Loring at Notch about that. And that was one of the things that he mentioned straight. I was like, their decoction vessel makes me so jealous.
Yeah. It's pretty nice to have for sure. Yeah. But there, you can also do it without one. You know, a lot of brewers do it. So it's not just, you know, we don't need to toot a horn, you know, but yeah, it's all good. And then
you've got some fun toys that, yeah.
Yeah.
And strangely enough, you don't decoct all of your lagers, just some of them. We'll talk about that later on.
But yeah, that's pretty much my, you know, my story here. And then.
Sure. Jack, how about you?
Yeah, I guess I kind of got into beer in Washington, D.C. I went to college there, and even though there weren't any breweries, it was a great beer town. Everyone wanted to distribute there. So, yeah, after college, I started working for a beer bar, started homebrewing, and, yeah, went from bar backing to taking the Siebel Domans program. That kind of got me through to taking the next step. After that, I moved up to Maine to work for Oxbow Brewing Company. So, started out as their first apprentice and then just kind of worked into every position up there possible. And yeah, they didn't have a quality program, so my position was kind of born out of necessity. You know, any farmhouse brewery will probably run into exploding bottles and overcarbed stuff. So my job was kind of figured out. And then that just really expanded into everything else from there. I was there for about 5 years. And then in 2020, saw an opening for a position here. And I always came up to Stowe to vacation. I always loved Von Trapp lagers. And when the opportunity presented itself, I was just like, yeah, I could live here and do this. So yeah, it came up in the middle of the pandemic. It was pretty crazy trying to start a lab when lab supplies were scarce due to COVID. Yeah. And yeah, since then, just been working with Tom and our awesome crew, just developing our lagers, making them better, more stable, consistent. And yeah, just really, really loving being here. So yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, DC is such a great hub for beer because they can bootleg beer in if it's not distributed locally. And of course, have some of the best beer bars in the country, thanks to the Neighborhood Restaurant Group and the, you know, the Church Key, Blue Jacket, Sovereign, all, I mean, just phenomenal places for beer. Well, tell me a little bit about why Von Trapp got into brewing. I mean, this is the family opened the lodge. They started with a small brewery and have now built a pretty large production brewery here. What was the drive to make beer here?
I think it stemmed back to Johannes, was, you know, the president, and he ran the whole, you know, the resort up here, and him and Sam, his son, and Christina, his daughter, they wanted to drink Austrian lager. So they were tired of, drinking Stella Artois, and they wanted to make their own style lager, and they thought bring a little Austria into Vermont. And you know, they started the brewery in 2010, and it's taken off since then.
And yeah, Johannes is like explicitly started this brewery to brew Helles. And if you think about 2010, what was going on in the beer landscape, like that was probably the least cool thing you could do, brew a Helles lager in the middle
absolutely,
of 100 IBUs and mixed firm saisons.
People are like, you're crazy doing this. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And so
people are lining up down the road for, you know, hazy IPA.
Oh, yeah.
And here we are going to make Helles here on a mountainside.
Absolutely. And now it's like come full circle. Lagers are hot and cool. And Helles is like a very fun beer to drink. And yeah, we thank him for his foresight on that.
Sure. Well, I want to talk a little bit about how how you structure that. You say Austrian lager, which sets a clear flag for the type of lager that you want to make. I want to talk about how you define that, how you approach that. Obviously, the lines are loose. It's not not hardcore. This is what it is. This isn't what it is. And you all do play across the lager range too. So I want to talk about how you define what are some of those commonalities that make Von Trapp lager. Before we do that, streamline efficiency with Omega Yeast's Diacetyl Knockout Series. The DKO series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diacetyl before it starts. The strains you know now better, available now for made-to-order pitchables at any volume. Contact Omega Yeast today at omegayeast.com. Also, ABS Commercial has been a full-service brewery outfitter for over 10 years. They're proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country, as well as equipment for distilling, cider making, wine making, and more. They know the ins and outs of the brewing and installation process and can design the perfect setup for you, whether you're just starting out or looking to expand. Contact them today at sales@abs-commercial.com to discuss your customized brewery needs. ABS Commercial, we are brewers. And if you're a brewer who's interested in distilling, subscribe now to the Craft Spirits and Distilling Podcast, available on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Hosted by Sydney Jones, head distiller for Few Spirits in Chicago, and Molly Troop, master distiller for Freeland Spirits in Portland, Oregon. This podcast explores the technical and creative processes behind great spirits through conversations with some of the leading distillers working today. It's everything you love about the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast, but focused on distilling. Click on the link in the show notes and give it a listen. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what Australian ert.
Good day, mate.
I screwed it up already. Austrian style lager. Sometimes the break, you just start saying something and then the sounds keep filling in there.
No, yeah, I agree, Jamie. I kind of said it wrong myself. We Austrian lagers, we do German lagers. And sure, I think me just saying Austrian lagers is probably wrong as well. So we kind of branch out with, all European style lagers.
Yeah, and it's general catch-all. Bavaria, sure. Austria, very similar. So we're just kind of doing everything in that vein.
Yeah. No, the borders for beer are pretty porous in that area. And having said that, also, when you look at even what is Bavarian lager is very different depending on where in Bavaria you are. It's a big difference between Munich and Franconia. Or I shouldn't say a big. There's a difference between those things and in the Oberpfalz and wherever you are. There's a nice range there. So let's talk about where it starts, and let's start talking about Helles. Where does Von Trapp Helles start? As you think about what constitutes the beer, what do you think are some of the keys that define it?
For me, having spent some time in Munich drinking Helles, it's just absolute approachability, drinkability, accessibility. Helles is cheaper than water when you go over there, and it's for every person, every occasion, and it's clean, it's balanced, it's just crisp, enjoyable. No one thing's taken over the set spotlight. It's malty but not sweet. It's hoppy but not bitter. It's just perfectly balanced. And how I think about it, it's like when you're drinking Helles and you have to think about it, something's off, something's stealing your attention. Good Helles is just there to enjoy.
You use the crispy word, which I think can be dangerous, especially because I think the way that some brewers in America think about crispy is not exactly the way that you think about, a Helles, which also has, some fullness in the malt character to it. Talk to me about, malt in that Helles.
Sure. So we don't decoct our Helles. We employ a 90-minute boil just to get all those good, malt characters, but it ferments dry. So it is on the drier, crisp side for that beer style.
How dry?
Finish is usually 2.5, 2.6. So not, bone dry by any means, but
right.
Still with a little bit of body.
It's not super crispy. That's
totally
okay.
But for us, that's kind of our target range, and most of our beers will get there, some higher. Still with that malt perception, perceived malt sweetness, just fermented out.
How do you say perceived malt sweetness? How are you what do you do to accomplish that? And I mean, some of it's going to be malt selection. Is there malt that you really love for Helles?
Yeah. So we only use Weihermann Pilsner malt for it. Okay. A little bit of Carafoam, little Munich, just kind of round it out. But 90-minute boil can
little
really,
bit of Carafoam, little bit of Munich. Okay.
Yeah. And just really brings out the honey, the bread dough, all those kind of subtly sweet characters. And it just presents very nicely.
Yeah, so not a single malt beer then. That's cool. And it's good to because there are a lot of folks that will be making with straight Pilsner malt. And it's interesting to think, and again, I've had conversations with other lager brewers who are using small percentages of some of these to build just a little, just small, you know, we're not talking about huge flavor. We're just talking about small things.
Yeah. And I even brought up to Jack, like possibly using like Heidelberg, and he was like, I don't know, that might be too light in color and not even perceived. So we really enjoy the Weirman Pilsner malt. It gives a little bit more, you know, SRM, and it's what we kind of achieved to do.
And you have indoor malt silos.
Yeah, those are wonderful.
And imagine you use that same Weirman Pilsner for other beers that you make too.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a base malt for sure.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So when it comes to, building that, how do you work with that malt through the kind of mash process to build character in it, but also hit the kind of attenuation goals that you're looking for?
I mean, step mash, we pretty much step mash everything in-house here. Some of our other brews, we mash in a little higher to bring that malt sweetness, but, Helles, we mash in at 143 and then slowly raise up.
Yeah.
And, runoff is slow. We're trying to get as clear wort as possible. So wort clarification, super fine, longer time of wort clarification, and just try to run off slow and boil longer for that roundness. And Jack, you have any input on that?
Yeah, and just definitely not letting last runnings get too low. We're very, very conscious of that.
Yeah.
Because, so many lagers out there have that just like astringent, grainy quality, possibly due to that. And that's something we definitely want to avoid.
And crush too, the crush of the grain, we're checking that. Yeah, we just don't want it too fine. We do crush some powder, some flour in there. It does help bring out, expose some of those enzymes, but we still have a good husk and, sieve test, and see where it's at, and it helps with the runoff. And you could tell when your crush is off and you're struggling through a runoff, you know what's going on with your differential pressures and, seeing how it's flowing.
Yeah. How do you balance the flour, the finer crush with, that kind of,
I want to say 10% possibly of it. And
And so while milling, you will change the, the mill settings?
No, it has a flour. It has it's a four roller Kunzel mill, and it does bring in that flour crush. And,
so it would diverts while it's a certain portion of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting. How do you balance between those two?
Once the setting is there, it's kind of, it's set, and then as the malt changes yearly, we can tell that the plumpness of it. So we'd look at the plump and then, we get a sample. And then if it's, like I said, the runoff is struggling or it's by just millimeter, really small adjustments and, just maybe open it up a hair and, kind of adjust accordingly that way.
Do you do that each time you get new shipments or the COAs? How often do the COAs change on those?
COAs, it's usually like yearly. Yeah. So the COA, we get we probably order every 2 weeks Pilsner, 50,000 pound, and we get the COA. And the biggest adjustment is not the size of the malt, it's more of the pH we're seeing that
pH.
We have. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that really
not protein levels, it's pH.
Yeah, the protein levels are holding pretty true. I'm gonna say like 9 to 10. 9 to 10. But it's more
those nice European barley lower protein levels.
But some people say you might also want to check them. Just because
double check.
Okay, that's okay. It. But yeah, it's more
trust but verify, right?
Exactly. So, but the pH is what and we use acidulated malt to balance that, and that's what.
How much variety are you seeing in pH on that?
It's at like 6 right now, and maybe up and down. Half a point. Huh. That's it. Not too much, but enough.
But enough that you need to balance that.
Yeah,
out.
Huh. Absolutely.
Interesting.
And then Jack, what would you say about like the adjustment of the pH and how it affects the beer?
Obviously we're looking for a knockout around like 5.2 or so. And after fermentation, hopefully 4.2 to 4.4. And we're generally hitting that. Our water source is pretty stable, consistent pH. So it's mostly just brew house where that's coming from. But yeah, I think we can knock that with acidulated. So if we're brewing a 200, we'll get four turns. So if we notice something on the first turn, we can adjust on turns 2, 3, and 4 just to, you know, accommodate that.
Sure.
And we're not using lactic or phosphoric. We're using the acidulated malt, trying to be as traditional.
Not purely Reinheitsgebot, but in the spirit of it.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Not going to claim it, but you're going to at least stay closer to it if you can. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's 2024. You know, we're trying to.
Sure. You know. Well, why do it that way instead of.
I don't know. It's just kind of what we try to produce here. We're just trying to keep it as traditional as possible, really.
Sure, sure. And you mentioned water, which is, I thought it's amazing. This water all comes off of a spring further up the mountain, and you have your own spring-fed brewery to do this kind of volume in a 50-barrel brew house, which is really impressive to get that kind of water and be able to brew this way.
Yeah, it is. It's almost scary. Because I'm like, what if it runs dry? It makes me a little nervous.
Right.
And they also use it for the snowmaking system up at our cross-country ski trail. So we're milking it for everything it's got.
Yeah.
Pushing it hard. Awesome. Awesome. Well, so that mash process that you go through in order to hit that kind of attenuation and goal, anything else that you you pay attention to there, you know, on your steps or then through loudering?
I mean, that's pretty much it. It's just basic, you know, I think really just basic brewing practices. For the mash, and that's nothing fancy.
What's hot side then look like?
Hot side is a 90-minute boil.
Why 90?
We were doing less, and it just rounds it out. Jack kind of brought it up and was like, maybe drive off some of those. We were seeing like a touch of, what is it, acetaldehyde?
No, Weyermann Pilsner malt's like notorious for DMS. And first came in, I was like, holy shit, like this is popping at 60 minutes. So we took it up to 75 and we still got it. And we actually sent it out for DMS testing. And it's like, okay, this is actually working. Like people do this for a reason. So then we just upped everything to 90 minute and it's, no DMS. The rest of it's driven off during fermentation. So yeah, it's just like we have no tolerance for it in our beers. I know some people do. Sure. It's like a round character to some lagers, but we just prefer it's not there.
Yeah. So 90 minutes is only for that DMS control. It's not, doesn't have anything to do with, extra boil off or, color in the beer.
Yeah, I don't think we noticed any real SRM change. Right. And any like.
It's a steam system, so.
Yeah. Not direct fire. Yeah. External calandria. And it boils at 216. It's super hot, but we don't see anything.
And then you're not trying to concentrate the beer any longer through that extra boil off.
No.
Yeah. What's hopping then look like in Helles? What were your ultimate IBU goals for Helles?
I think 20.
Yeah, 20, 22. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty mild.
Yeah.
It's Perle. It's we used to do first runnings, first wort. And then now we just added at 60 to kind of not have as much bitterness, just like to Jack to kind of balance it, like to make it hoppy but not bitter. And it's Perle and I want to say Tetnang.
Yeah, Tetnang and Hellertau.
Yeah.
Why those hops?
They just play well together. I mean, hops from Hellertau is just we were using all hops just directly from the Hellertau region, and we just find that makes a nice balanced bouquet and. No hop really shines too much in it.
Yeah. And it's just lightly floral, not super peppery, not super spicy, not earthy. Nice fun balancing component to it.
Yeah. And it's all at 60 minutes or do you then throw some in later on?
No, later addition as well. Yeah. We have a 0 minute flame out. Oh. It's 60 minute and then just the 0 minute flame out. That's it.
A flame out addition would seem to be more aromatically driven, even though I wouldn't say I necessarily associate Helles with aromatic hops like that.
No.
Tell me why that decision.
I think just to try to get some of the aromatic, but when it transfers over into the whorl, it takes so much time as well. You're actually picking up some IBU character and it's still at, 180 during a knockout. Through the chiller, we try to knock it out as quick as possible, but we're getting a solmerization for sure.
It's a large enough batch and takes a long enough time that
you're not getting that.
You're not cool pooling like the IPA kids that are just trying to. Yeah.
No, not yet.
Okay.
Still time.
Sure. Well, let's keep following the process from there. You knock out, you whirlpool, knock out,
Yeah, Knockout Temp. We were varying as well. We were kind of going 49 to 54 on some beers, and then the start of the process, we were kind of missing some of the fermentation temperature, so we just set it to 52, and we're finding great success at that. Less confusing in the brew house as far as like having every beer at a different temperature, and we didn't see a change on.
Yeah, and 52 is definitely a sweet spot. Not a lot of ester production, not a lot of higher alcohols. We over aerate just to control that as well. We over pitch a little too. We generally shoot for like 25 million cells per mil, and that gets us that sweet spot of like clean fermentation, not too much aggressive yeast in the tank, and yeah, really, really consistent 2-week fermentation, passes D test, and then we're just good to start chilling.
That seems expensive, though. I mean, I guess you've got some pretty large yeast prop tanks here and can manage that process yourself. How do you? I mean, there are a lot of tanks, so it's 16 200 barrel tanks in here, and a lot of fermentation's going when you all are fully ripping. Managing
it's,
that,
it smells great in here.
Yeah,
when all fermentations are going.
Sure. But that's also a lot of organization on you know, making sure that you've got the right amount of yeast for the right brews at the right time, and you know, everything is hitting at, you know, in the right moments. How do you manage that, Jack?
Tom and I probably spend hours every week just mapping out yeast and like seeing what's there. We do what's called just kind of like prop and feed. So instead of a full from lab propagation, we'll, you know, harvest from a tank, feed it equal amounts of pounds of wort, give it 24 hours, and then we, you know, that's good for 3 to 4 pitches for full 200 barrel batches. And then, yeah, we have multiple generations going, and yeah, my job just make sure that they're clean, happy, healthy, free of any contamination. And yeah, we generally hit our targets all the time, and yeah, our fermentation's been consistent. So yeah, it's what works for us. I know a lot of people do it differently, but yeah, and then we'll start.
Why does it work for you?
Just because we know what to expect, and like, yeah, we get consistent results, and yeah, it's just what, how we've made it work, you know?
How many generations, Jack?
For each fresh pitch, we can get up to E or like 5 or 6 gens, and then we'll, you know, order fresh stuff. But yeah, we don't like to push it past that, really.
And the yeast that you use, what is there a particular lager yeast?
It's a YU's Bavarian strain. And yeah, it works well for us. We know like a lot of people like the 3470 out there. Personally, that's a little, you know, too much struck match sulfur dioxide for me. Ours is a little cleaner, just a little breadier, a little touch of fruit. But yeah, it's great.
There's some, I mean, 3470 is a workhorse, obviously, but a lot of people use 3470. And so
there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, that's great.
But at the same time, a lot of people use 3470. And so you end up with a lot of beers that taste like 3470. And there's some value in doing things a little bit differently. When you think about what, you know, that those flavors that your fermentation, flavors and aromas that your fermentation produces, you're trying to keep a minimal, but there's also some, you know, some impact of that. How do you manage and adjust that yeast to get exactly, you mentioned over pitching, over aerating. That would seem to also maybe get it ripping a little too much, and might actually add more character to that. How do you balance those things?
Yeah, I guess it's a controlled over pitching, you know. Okay. We're not like blasting it with yeast so it's getting, you know, too fast. Like, we're fermenting at 1 to 2 degrees Play-Doh a day. So it's not like a 3-day turnaround on any of these beers. It takes its time, and it's, you know, predictable. And yeah, one of the big thing is, yeah, just driving off hydrogen sulfide during production. We don't shut our tanks until it's all gone and out of there. Then yeah, just knowing when to do our
Good sulfur is good sulfur, and the bad sulfur is bad sulfur.
Absolutely. Yeah. We know how to control that. And then
how do you test for that?
We don't have any super crazy lab instruments to do that. So yeah, we're just sniffing every day and just making sure.
Every day.
Yep. And then, yeah, we know when to shut the tank for spunding. And yeah, again, just making sure all the sulfur's out of there. And
I feel like we get a little sulfur sometimes in the spooning. I pick up on it. Yeah.
And hopefully
it's the good sulfur.
Good sulfur. Yeah. And with lagering, hopefully that'll clean up a little.
But I imagine you also are really just following gravity and have a gravity-based kind of trigger for taking those next steps. And unless, for example, you're sensing extra sulfur in that.
Right. And then we'll let it ride. And if it's a tank we're going to harvest yeast from, we'll let that, you know, stay open a little longer. We don't want to put it under too much pressure, and yeah, just treat it gently.
Yeah, and I feel like even though we make these beers like consistently every day, you're always learning something new. Everything's changing. And to pay attention is like the key to a quality lager program. Because once you get complacent and kind of not pay attention, Jack is extremely like diligent about that. Like every day I'm like, all right, you know, today's a new day. And it really is in fermentation land.
At the same time, there's a certain amount of overhead challenge to that, you know, given the number of tanks that you have to monitor on it and, you know, where everything is at every given time. Like that's a lot of labor to keep track of that. But at the same time, it's also like you've got 200 barrels of beer in each tank and you can't afford to lose any of that. No. They have to be, you know.
Yeah, it's tough. And lager brewing, like if we get 11 turns out of a tank, that's a great year. You know, because you're not flipping these tanks. They're taking 40 days. Right. So yeah, every batch is, you know, means something to us. We don't take it for granted by any means. I don't, but.
Yeah. And a lot of the QC process, it's super monotonous. It's repetitive, but like if you're into it and you want to stay on top of it, like you can make it work and it's just, you can do it blindfolded over time.
Sure. Now you're also fermenting in cylinder conicals and, you know, you don't have giant lagering tanks, separate lagering tanks here. And so I want to talk about how you all manage that, because you're absolutely finding that kind of, you know, classic lager character in these beers and conditioning them, like you say, and you're doing it again with vertical cylinder conicals. I want to talk a little bit about that. But first, this episode is sponsored by Yakima Chief Hops. Yakima Chief Hops launched Varieties Supply Company, their own brand of hop apparel inspired by hop varieties, art, and community. Shop designs from various artists inspired by your favorite varieties, including Citra, Simcoe, Sabro, and Mosaic. Shop Varieties and use promo code CBB20 for 20% off. And that's Varieties, VarieTees.com. Also, if you're opening or expanding a brewery, getting your building right is one of the most important things you'll ever do. The architects at OPA Design Studio are your partners in developing the unique design you need. With over a decade of experience designing breweries, the folks at OPA are here to serve as your trusted experts from start to finish with their full range of architectural services. Visit designopa.com to set up your no obligation introductory consultation today. designopa.com. Let's talk about lager fermentation in cylinder conicals. You know, it's very much in vogue to use horizontal lagering tanks. And yet at the same time, I've talked to plenty of award-winning brewers that are making fantastic lagers and cylinder conicals, including you all right here. So talk to me about how, you know, what that process looks like then for fermentation, that you're, since you're, you know, not moving this beer after fermentation, or are you moving and, you know, after primary is done into a, yet another cylinder conical. Talk to me about that whole process.
It's a uni tank, Jamie. Okay. It's, we just, you know, pay attention to fermentation, then cropping is a big one. Mm. And we try to crop off of the yeast at roughly like 20 days, I want to say. So 14 days, 2 weeks fermentation, and slowly start pulling that yeast off. We do see some, like a little bit of haze in the, like I'd like it to be a little brighter personally.
Yeah, just the size of these tanks, it takes a lot longer for all of that stuff to actually drop out to the bottom. So yeah, our unfiltered beer is fairly unfiltered, but you know, that's why we have a centrifuge to clean that up down the line. But
sure.
Yeah, it's something we're working on, but it's great. Like the beer still tastes great off the tank. It's just, lots of yeast protein. And it was just,
they work,
but
for
you
sure.
Give it, you start giving it more time in order to accommodate that.
Yeah. Within reason too. We have to sell the beer, lagers. So we have to move them somewhat quickly, but, I mean, that's something we're working on and we're going to see, and, we're seeing possibly like we adjusted the runoff speed to slow it down to hopefully less particulates, and just pay attention to every, the hot side, to what's going on in the tank as well, to kind of see if anything improves on that.
So 2 weeks of fermentation time and you start pulling yeast off, and then where does it go from there?
It's roughly 30 days of lagering, right in that range, depending on sales and all that. But
you need to then, keep pulling things off the tank, or after you drop yeast, you're pretty good to just, seal it up and let it do its thing.
Yeah, we keep pulling, and then once it's moved, it's pretty bright by then. Mm-hmm.
30 days of lagering?
30 days of lagering, yeah.
With some exceptions.
With some exceptions, absolutely. Yeah. But
on both sides. Well, we can go longer, we can go shorter. I don't like going shorter, but yeah, I mean, COVID taught us something, like it's possible to overlager a beer, you know?
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Like,
what'd you learn from COVID overlagering?
Some of our beers, just the flavor would drop out. Like Helles would just kind of get muted if it lagered for too long. Pilsner would just kind of drop off. The hop character would, you know, just decline. So yeah, there's really a sweet spot. And I know some people swear by the longest time you can lager, the better, but you know, we're a production facility. We got to keep stuff moving along. And yeah, we've kind of found our sweet spot.
Where were some of those points where, you know, and it could be different for different beers, right? I imagine, yeah, you're absolutely right with Pilsner that, there's always that balance of hop character with that kind of long-term smoothness. You know, where's the point for Pilsner, and what do you think the point is for Helles? And again, this is just you and your cellar, and it's not necessarily applicable to everyone and, you know, no, and how they do it. But no, for you guys, what is like?
Yeah, I think anecdotally, just like anything past 90 days, you might start seeing that drop off for younger 5% Helles, Pilsner, whatever. And then Dunkel, our dark lager, actually hangs on a lot longer. So it around 80, 90 days tastes awesome. We wish we could do that for every batch, but you know, it's still on the same kind of schedule as everything else.
Yeah. And then Oktoberfest, you guys are starting up Oktoberfest brewing now, right?
Yeah, in May 1st. It's kind of sad, but we're just getting out of winter and it's like, all right, let's brew a fall autumn beer. It's really, you know, it's hard on you a little bit, Jamie, I'm not going to lie. But no, we want to lager it longer.
I mean, who would think that lager beer is contributing to seasonal creep? But yeah, you know, but here it is.
No.
And like I was saying to Jack earlier, at least you're not making pumpkin beer right
now. Not yet. Not yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, we want to lager that one longer as well. Sure, we find that the Munich malt, the darker malt, can hold up and lager for exponential longer time. Yeah.
Cool. So then you just centrifuge out of the tanks, get it nice and bright and into a bright tank, and then package.
We measure NTU, turbidity units as it's going out, and try to get it as bright as possible. Some, you know, some of the darker beers, excuse me, it will be a higher end on that, just to not to strip out any flavors that we kind of want in there.
Sure, sure. Well, let's flip around then. We've been talking about Helles and also generally talked about the you know, the process in that. Let's talk about some of the creative design of some of your other beers. And you know, maybe we can start by talking about that Oktoberfest, since it's now on one of our beers of the year. And you know, when it came to designing an Oktoberfest beer, you know, how did Von Trapp start thinking about what a Von Trapp Oktoberfest beer was going to be?
We went with the Marzen style. We dabbled in the Fest beer last year, and we really enjoyed that as well. But the Marzen style Munich malt is the powerhouse. I'm going to say 85%, roughly.
And it's a blend of Munich 1 and 2.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. Let's give it those. Yeah, nice round. It's not too sweet, though, I feel like.
Blend of 1 and 2. What?
For the color, the 2 brings the color, and yeah, it just kind of brings it up a little bit for the body.
And again, like, we want this on like the drinkable, crushable side. So some Oktoberfest out there just like sweet caramel fat bombs, and that's not what we're about. Like, we want, drinkability. 35 IBUs, and 5.6%. So on the lower end of it, but that's kind of what we enjoy, and a lot of other people do too.
You know where that finishes in gravity?
That's right around 3. So, okay. Yeah.
Still lean, but also, you know, satisfying, but enough that you can keep drinking it, liter after liter.
Yeah,
totally.
Mash in a little higher, run it over into the decoction, decoct for 20 minutes. And then once it brings back over, the mash back over, it'll, mash out at 170. And the runoffs can be tricky on Munichs as well. The Munich malt, the darker malt can be tricky.
Yeah. Now, you bring up a good point there with decoction that I didn't talk about in the scope of Helles, but you don't decoct your pale lagers.
We used to, and that's one of Sam's kind of, he's the owner, and you know, he's big beer advocate, and he's always asking us if we can, but it's a delicate, you know, beer. Sure. And we don't feel like we need to bring that body and you know, but it's still up for debate. You know, we could do it. We'll stay tuned.
Yeah. So it's just really a body issue.
I think so. Yeah. Body. And it's such a light beer. We don't want to bring
Yeah, I think we get more character out of decoction with our darker beers just because it like kind of amplifies those Maillard flavors and carries it forward. You know, I know obviously Bohemian Pilsner, very well known decocted beer. We just don't do it and it still works for us, you know.
Interesting. Well, how do you capture in a pale Bohemian style lager that same kind of Czech fullness without, I mean, because there are. I mean, we spent some time in the Czech Republic last year. I mean, decoction is just brewing. It's not a special thing. It's not like we do this extra thing. It's just brewing. Yeah. It's how you brew. You know, do you make other concessions then if, you know, in terms of recipe and design? If
Yeah, with some beers, like, it's just how it was kind of developed and where we sit. And, you know, other beer, we did a Czech pale lager with Human Robot, and that was a double decocted beer with, you know, Raven Malt, and that's a wonderful Czech malt that we used, and it really showed like how much like body it brought, and the double decoction really did help. And I hear you with the Czech style Bohemian pills, but it seems to be working, so we're sticking with it.
I would never tell you how to do things, not after you've got two medals at GABF World Beer Cup for that.
No,
beer.
We're always open for improving and ideas and all that.
I'm just curious. I mean, I think it's interesting to have all of this technology that you could use and be, you know, where it's all all you have to do is program the system to do it.
Easy, Jamie.
You have the best automated decoction setup. There are plenty of brewers that make production decisions because, you know, it's driven by, you know, equipment, process, time, people. And that isn't the concern here. You can make that decision purely based on
sensory,
on what you want the beer to be.
That's it.
And so that's what I find interesting, that you are consciously making that decision solely for what you want the end product to be, having been able to do it both ways, test those against each other. Not, you know, we don't end up with a lot of, you know, conversations with folks that are like, well, I had them both, you know, and we just liked the non-decocted version better. And so I'm just trying to understand that, what the difference is there and what you all like about that non-decocted version.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Jack kind of, you know, we rely on him heavily, and our coworkers have amazing palates, and we do a sensory program once a week, and we're always up for ideas and seeing what could evolve from it. So you're not wrong with, we possibly could, you know, go back to the decocted Pilsner, you know, but we're just,
I am 100% not saying you should do anything. I am just trying to, you know, don't put that on me, Tom. Jack, from your perspective, what is it about that non-decocted that that you find makes it a little bit whatever?
I think, I don't know, I've had some Czech pale lagers that are just like super caramelly, malty, almost like to a fault, and this, we just keep it lean, it's lighter, it's more drinkable, it's like closer to a Bavarian pils than anything, and that works for us and our customer base. And it's, again, we're just going to keep on it until we want to do something different. So we're fine with it.
The German side of Bohemia or Austria, whatever, however that is. That's interesting. But then, you know, getting back to Oktoberfest, you definitely then decocked on that because you find that there you're looking for more of that kind of fullness in the beer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we're definitely getting some more malt depth character without that added sweetness, just because, again, it's, you know, finishing at 3, fermenting a little drier. And same with our Dunkel, like, we get a lot of great malt character out of that. It's decocted as well, but still clean and dry and drinkable, you know?
When you decoct those darker or amber beers, you know, what's that decoction process look like?
I mean, the darker beers, what's the color? What were you saying?
Are you decocting for a significant amount of time? You know, what's that, kind of, time and then process look like when you're decocting these?
It takes a while to heat up. So, you know, it's based on your ratio of what you transfer over. Mm-hmm. So if you bring over less, it'll heat up quicker and, you know, you can move it along quicker. But
you just pull in one third.
One third, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Just, I mean, it's pretty traditional.
But your standard Rolex system can get that warm pretty fast, right?
It does take time. Oh, no, okay. It takes 30 minutes to heat up to boil, and then to sustain that boil. Once you're there, you can really see it rolling and caramelizing. And we just do. You know, everyone kind of varies, but we strive for at least 20 minutes at least, and then sometimes we hit 30. It also affects the runoff, so you don't want to beat it up like too much, you know, by boiling it and degrading the husks for runoff. But
and your system is still pretty gentle about its boils.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it varies. I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
It seems to work for now, but so a minimum of 20 minute decoction.
Yeah. Just,
you can really see it caramelize in there, and that's kind of what you're going for.
Yeah. And then the Oktoberfest is a single decoction?
Single decoction, yeah.
When do you double decoct?
That was just with Human Robot, and then Andrew down there and Kenny came up, and they pushed our limits. And that's the beauty of these kind of, you know, Stowe style, these one-off brews we do. We kind of work together with other breweries, and their ideas come into play, and they challenge us. And, you know, we accept the challenge, and it's fun to do. And yeah.
And yeah, a lot of these beers, we don't have a time to like do a pilot batch. So, you know, we just brewed 200 barrels of maple Dunkelweizen and it was great. We just went for it. And, you know, that was also decocted and added 150 gallons of maple syrup to the kettle or the whirl. And yeah, it's fun. It's pushing us and it's like really making us rely on our research, our sensory program, just to think about what we want and just go for it.
I love how, when you look at collaborations, it was so driven by the IPA brewers for so long. And now there's this undercurrent clique of lager brewers all collaborating with each other.
Yeah.
And building this other, other community. And so, yeah, you get to learn, you know, understand techniques and approaches and kind of spread those things
different
around.
Different malts, Jamie, is what I've learned a lot.
Oh, yeah?
Like, yeah, just different companies, different, you know, providers of malt and producers, growers, and I see so much like flavor variance with the different malts that normally we always use the Weirmann malt. And
sure.
It really, yeah. The Raven Check malt, I was really happy with that. Yeah.
Have any of your collaborations then yielded, some different beers for you all because now you're aware of these other ingredients and intrigued by them and want to build something around them?
Again, to those Czech beers, like we brewed a Tamave with Counterweight a couple years back and like we just loved the Bohemian floor malted stuff. So we brewed that beer again because we really enjoyed it. And yeah, we want to keep a kind of Czech series going here. You know, we're known for our Bavarian style. So we just want a kind of Czech wing to our portfolio, even if it's just for us in the beer hall. Just working with different malts. It's, you know, we're not bored with Weirmann or anything. It's still amazing malt. But
yeah,
just allowing us to branch out. Our portfolio isn't crazy huge. So yeah, anything we can do to like try something out, R&D, and just work with what's out there.
Let's keep talking about dark lager, and maybe we talk about Dunkel a little bit. That balancing that big malt character with this drinkability is an interesting challenge on the beer design side. How do you all approach that from a malt perspective?
Malt perspective would just be the Munich malt really drives that one for the caramel and the decoction. There's a little bit of Munich too, I want to say in there, and then a touch of Carafa dehusked.
A touch is a couple of percent or?
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe a percent, like
a percent.
It's like 80 pounds for 2000. So, it's not very much at all.
Just, right.
You don't want that astringency and you want it to be smooth, roasty a little bit, but
that is a fraction of a percent.
Yeah. Thank you, Jamie. Yeah. My math is a little off.
I'm terrible at math too. But
which is sad.
It's like 1% of 2000. That's 200. And we're talking about eight. Okay. Less than half a percent.
Yeah. Yeah. Boom. You just want that. And then
it just takes me a second. I'm a little slow. I've only had two cups of coffee.
Yeah.
Or three.
Sorry. Yeah. The Haas. And then also, you know, you can add it. We used to add it in the Lauterton.
Yeah.
Just, you know, to avoid any of that astringency.
Right.
But the safety on the Lauterton doesn't allow us to do it. But just to give it that color but not the roastiness and let that the Munich malt kind of shine through and give it that velvety
so you are then pushing this these darker malts through the decoction process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But to your point,
that's why you're using a lot less of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
A small amount,
that makes more sense because you want to be careful about you know, pushing that kind of roastier, astringent character through darker malts.
And they, you know, they offer, you know, Carafa 3 is it the extra dark, and you can get away with using less of the darker malt, and it kind of helps.
So use Carafa 3 then?
We use it in our Schwarz beer, which we didn't want that astringency in it. We just wanted it to be the black pills. So,
right. And we actually don't decoct our Schwarz beer because we don't want those acrid, astringent roast notes to really get amplified. We just want to keep that clean and tight and, buttoned up.
Yeah.
Interesting. Hey, let's keep talking. I'm curious about this. We don't talk about dark lager, you know, a whole bunch. Yeah. But anything else to that kind of, you know, how do those mashes differ from your pale lagers?
Yeah, just higher mash, you know, mash in temp is a little higher. Move it over to decoction, maybe
for a Dunkel or for a Schwartz. Like, do you have, what are those kind of finishing gravities?
Dunkel's 3 and then Schwartz is going to be 2.
Yeah. Dunkel's 2.83, Schwartz is like 2.56. So close to Helles Pilsner, everything else. And still on the higher attenuated dry side.
Yeah, mashing, you know, a little lower on the Schwartz and then a little higher on the Dunkel and try to get that full body, less conversion.
Yeah. Anything, you know, how do those feel on the hot side then?
75 minute boil for the Dunkel. Yeah, we just kind of, we don't boil as long and it seems to be working. You know, just also part of the process is just, you know, when you boil 90 minutes decocting, you're looking at a good amount of hours brewing, which we never want to cut corners, but we still have other things to do at the end of the day.
Yeah. We want to keep our staff.
Yeah. But, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can pull out a little bit and talk about, you know, what the finer points of quality then in this, because, you know, your process isn't, you know, terribly different from, from a lot of other lager brewers. And yet the lagers that you make are obviously distinctive, award-winning, you know, and have, you know, created interest from folks like us and, you know, judges at competitions and like, if you kind of think about it in a, you know, bigger way, what do you think some of those key functions are that, that support, you know, this expression of quality in what you do? What are some of the things that that are making some differences there?
I'm going to say the water, Jack.
Yeah, water's huge. We have such a great canvas to work with our water. You know, the mineral profile is very similar to Pilsen. So like very neutral, low, soft. And yeah, just we don't add anything. We don't take
low
anything.
And soft. What do you mean in terms of like TDS or?
And mineral profile, like little magnesium, little calcium, all of that. And yeah, it's just a really great blank canvas to work with. And yeah, it really works for all of our beers. We've talked about adjusting for things like our Munich Dunkel, but again, it's working and we're just going to keep going with it.
Yeah. And then I think yeast management, I think the not going too far into generations and just kind of, you know, keeping an eye on that, keeping it healthy, viable.
Yeah, that's huge. Like so many off flavors come from poor yeast quality and poor yeast health. And yeah, just over pitching, over attenuating. Like we're conscious of all those things at every step in the process and step chilling instead of, you know, hard crashing just to preserve the health of it. And
what do you mean by that? I mean, I know what you mean by that, but
sure. Yeah. Step chilling just like allows the yeast to gradually settle to the bottom of the tank rather than like forcing it down there before we crop it. And it just allows it to clean up a little more diastole, a little more.
What does a step crash feel like for you all?
Probably around 3 days and just slowly, you know, some people do it like a degree a day.
Yeah.
And, but you know, once again, time wise, so it's about 3 days. It's probably, I'm going to say 7 degrees roughly a day, you know, somewhere in there.
And then, yeah, that just gives us better yeast to harvest from if we want to repropagate and, yeah, just keeps the cellar healthy.
So you step crash and then you pull yeast and then you're going to, do you drop it more at that point then to get down to a lagering temperature?
Yeah, we'll drop it more. And then it also helps with the centrifuge.
Where do you get to at the end of your step crash to pull yeast?
With the temperature?
Yeah.
In Fahrenheit, roughly, like we set it for 28 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm.
Yeah. So as cold as possibly, just to lengthen those chains. So when we run it through the centrifuge, it can pull as much particulates out as possible to make it bright for the lighter.
And then where do you lager at? Or that's your lagering temp?
That's lager temp. Yeah.
What's your crashing temp?
I mean, crashing temp is going to like it just, we gradually set it. So it's just, you know, we start at 52, raise up to 56, and then just kind of slowly drop down.
Raise up to 50. That's your your diacetyl rest. Yeah, up to 56, 4 degrees.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I guess we could float to 60. Yeah. But this, you know, Vermont's cold. So sometimes it won't even, this building can be a little chilly. So sometimes even getting to 60 is a difficult, you know, we brew a Weiss beer in here. Sometimes it's hard to get up to that 60, 72, you know, float. But yeah, so.
And then you just, you know, at that diacetyl rest temperature, how long does it stay there?
It's like 4 to 6 days.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. When it's on day 12, 13, 14, we'll do forced diacetyl check and, then once it passes, we'll start chilling it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, Jack grabs it every day and puts it in a hot water bath at, 150?
Yeah, 150, 20 minutes, and Tom comes in and pretends not to see it so he doesn't have to taste it. And so it's mostly on me and the other brewers. But, yeah, again, it's one of those, like, things of monotony I was talking about. Like, do it every damn day, and, like, you'll know what's going on.
Yeah.
So maybe in that sense, it's the discipline that, you know, that also...
I'm disciplined, you know. Jamie. Come on. I'm disciplined.
I sense that from you, Tom. I'm sensing that. Yeah. And then lagering at 28, you know, and then...
30 days. 30 days. Okay. 30 days. Try our best. I mean, you know, 21 is...
Right.
A lot of things that I've read is 21 days is minimum. So that's us, but...
So we've got those two pieces of excellence. Is there anything to other material handling, you know, that you find may yield that? Because, you know, whether that's the way that you're crushing and handling malt, or, you know, that you find may help the overall excellence of the beer.
Yeah, I think you're right with the crush. Honestly, like, to get rid of that graininess and, you know, to make sure that your wort is clear and, you know, you're running off slow and, you know, taking the time, the time in the beginning, I think helps the quality at the end. And low DOs.
Yeah, DOs are obviously huge. So spunding is a great way to, you know, clear your tank of any O2 and just capture that CO2, and, you know, the yeast will eat the rest of it up during lagering. Just being gentle on the centrifuge and the bright. And we have a great packaging team. So going into the can, we can get single digit DOs, and, you know, that's really been huge for our beers.
Single digit DOs going into the can.
Yeah. 30 is like our top end target, but generally, we'll hit 8 to 15 on, you know, good days, normal days. So we kind of hold them to that, and they, you know, live up to it.
Is that 8 from the bright before it goes in the package, or is that 8 in TPO?
8 in TPO.
Hmm. Yep. That's great.
Yeah. We're lucky. We're fortunate.
Yeah, and with exceptions, of course. Yeah, like, absolutely. Our machine always needs tinkering and fixing, like all good canning lines
sure.
do.
I think you said that, Jamie. What's brewing? Cleaning and working on
cleaning
things.
Cleaning and fixing things.
Oh, my God.
Exactly.
That's it.
It all sounds like a sexy job, but, it's a lot. You know, it's the routine things that make the big difference there. What's most exciting about lager brewing for you all today? What, you know, obviously you've been at this a long time. Von Trapp is this place where you get to, you know, use great equipment and with owners that love the beer that you make and are, you know, aligned behind it because it's a family business with a family name on it. And they want that to reflect the quality, you know, of the whole family's brand. You know, cutting corners isn't the thing you do. They built this giant, you know, great production brewery on the family property, you know, just down the hill from the lodge itself. Like, it's very much about, you know, this place, this experience, but also, keeping it on that brand. You guys have a chance to, you know, play around the edges and make some fun things, do some collaborations, but you also have a lot of resources at your disposal to do what you want to do. What are you most excited about next?
Next is just seeing where the lager program goes here. I think everybody's really into it, and I think the next move would be, you know, just the Czech style series. I think that's a big hit. We just brought in like glassware next door that is, you know, traditional to the styles of beer, and we're really happy with that presentation. And I just...
Oh, more Czech style glassware to go with your Czech style lagers.
Well, the Czech glassware is just a dimple mug. But, right. I don't know. The program just here and just seeing and, you know, working with Austin and, you know, the people, like bringing people in and showing them how to like lager produce and, you know, how they react to the quality of beer. And that's fun for me, like seeing people, you know, growing and evolving.
Yeah, and I think just getting people more educated and excited about lagers as they have in the last few years. And we have a volume output where we can be that voice to educate, and our beer is accessible, which a lot of people equate accessibility with a lack of quality. But like, we're making a lot of good lagers to serve to a lot of good people. And yeah, we just want to get our name out there and show that like a Vienna lager is more than just like this fat caramel beer you get at the airport. Like, it's delicate, it's nuanced. You can show people that Dunkel lager isn't big and sweet and heavy and dark. It's actually like crisp and enjoyable. Yeah, just like getting people familiar with the finer points of lager brewing and inviting more people in. Cause yeah, lagers shouldn't be rare and special. Like, they're meant to be drunk and consumed. And we just want to invite more people to that.
You're making them accessible, and you're also, you know, managing that, making these beers here in I hate the word authentic, so I'm not going to use the word authentic, but in a way that's real and connected, and you're, you know, involved in the beer and, you know, on top of that quality all the time. Well, we see it in the beer itself, and obviously it's making waves for that same kind of reason, and very cool. And I appreciate you all talking with me about it today. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive 1 free year of remote control and monitoring. Take your operations to the next level with ProBrew. Old Orchard is the go-to source for fruit-forward ingredients for some of the biggest names in the craft brewing landscape. Omega Yeast's Diacetyl Knockout series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diacetyl before it starts. ABS Commercial are proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country. If you're a distiller or curious about it, check out the Craft Spirits and Distilling podcast. For hop-inspired artist-designed apparel, shop Varieties and use code CBB20 for 20% off. And the architects at OPA Design Studio are your partners in developing the unique design you need. If you've enjoyed this podcast, go to beerandbrewing.com, click on that subscribe button. And if you are a Craft Beer and Brewing subscriber, you can go back to that Best in Beer issue from 2018 and read what we wrote and as we named Oktoberfest from Von Trapp one of our best 18 beers of 2018. Tom, if you want to learn more about Von Trapp, where can they find you guys out there in real life and on the internet?
Yeah, you can find us on our website at VonTrappBrewing.com and Instagram under Von Trapp Brewing.
At Von Trapp Brewing.
At Von Trapp Brewing, yeah.
If they want to drink your beers in person, where do they find you? Where's this? You have a beer hall right here connected to the brewery.
Yeah, we have a beer hall. We have the cafe house. And yeah, come on down and we'll have a pint with you and it'll be great.
And yeah, check the beer finder tool on our website at VonTrappBrewing.com. Enter your zip code and find our beer near you. We're up and down the East Coast. We're expanding westward. And yeah, we're in a lot of new markets. So keep an eye out for our new beer, our new rebrand, our new logo. Yeah, it's out there.
Awesome. Jack, Tom, thank you guys for joining me. Cheers.
Yeah, hey, thank you, Jimmy. You.
Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those who love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew.